Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. Last time we worked on what was meant by the phrase, I was in the Spirit. And this evening we're going to look at the blessedness of John saying, on the Lord's day. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. There are some places in the book of Revelation that are addressed in our 1689 Confession of Faith. And this spot is one of them. This is, in effect, interpreted for us. We have help knowing the right interpretation of this from right in our confession. I'm going to read something from chapter 22, paragraph 7. Chapter 22, paragraph 7. And as I read, eventually you'll hear the phrase, the Lord's Day. As it is the law of nature that in general, a proportion of time by God's appointment be set apart for the worship of God, so by his word, in a positive moral and perpetual commandment binding all men in all ages, he hath particularly appointed one day in seven for a Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week, and from the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week, which is called the Lord's Day, and is to be continued to the end of the world as the Christian Sabbath, the observation of the last day of the week being abolished. Now the scripture proofs listed there do not contain the allusion that was made here to the beginning of the world, from the beginning of the world. But then there is reference to three other kinds of references to this. I'm going to add the reference from Genesis chapter 2 and then follow the scripture proofs. And in so doing, we are going to have, in effect, a mini biblical survey of the Lord's Day. You know, I've talked to you before about the way that the book of Revelation is kind of a consummation of everything that the Bible says. There are subjects raised on the first page of the Bible that are developed all through the Bible and then find kind of the final word or summary of that theme in the book of Revelation. Same thing happens with the Lord's Day. It's mentioned on the first or second page of the Bible, and then it's developed in many references throughout the Bible, showing what a blessing from God it is on us, and then finds its final mention here in the last book of the Bible. There's lots more to enjoy reading about the Lord's Day from beginning of the Bible to the end. And I'm seriously considering just reading, you know, lots of that material over the next couple of Wednesday evenings. But I'm going to do the mini version here at first. You know, the really fast, quickie version. So, Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. Guess I'll read verses 1, 2, and 3. Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. You know how with us the idea of resting means we have got tired and will be rejuvenated as we rest. That doesn't apply to God, of course, but the idea is that he ceased, he stopped. He was creating, then he stopped creating. So we have there the seventh day, the Sabbath day, instituted at creation. So everything that we will learn about the Sabbath day, the Lord's day, is started right there. The foundation of it is set right there. Everything that all of our ideas about the Lord's day need to be rooted right there. Nothing that we ever think about the Sabbath day or the Lord's day can be separated from that. We have to, you know, keep a foot right there as we find the right place to stand regarding the Lord's day. Would any of you brothers like to comment on that or ask something at this point about the original institution of the Sabbath day? In our confession, there is the term positive moral. I did a lot of research on this a few years ago, and you know, moral means it's a matter of right and wrong for all people everywhere. Positive means it's the kind of law that, well, it's the counterpart, it's the opposite of natural. You can tell that thou shalt not kill is natural law. You know it without ever reading it in the Bible that nobody should murder you. You know, thou shalt not steal. Oh, that's natural law. Positive law is law that you don't feel, it's not written inside of you. You would not know it unless it's said. That the proportion of time fitted for worshiping God rather than doing your own work is 1 day and 7. And that for that time, it's the seventh day of the week that should be the 1 in 7. Those things you do not know naturally, like you know, thou shalt not steal. However, it is moral in that it is not a matter of mere ceremony for Israel. It's not a matter that's merely judicial or civil of government for Israel. It's moral. It's a matter of right and wrong for all mankind. Well, in the earlier versions of this statement, for example, in the Westminster Confession, the words were not put exactly like they're put in our confession. In our confession, it says, by his word in a positive moral, and that's hyphenated, positive-moral, positive moral. Well, that language of positive moral as one term was under development throughout the 1700s. In the 1600s, that was under development. And the terms eventually came to be natural moral and positive moral. Natural hyphen moral, natural moral, and positive moral. Natural moral, meaning it's a matter of right and wrong for all mankind, and mankind knows it naturally, by nature. Never have to read the Bible to know that you don't want somebody to lie about you. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Yes, it appears in words in the Ten Commandments, but you already had that as, naturally. That's natural moral. And then something that's a matter of right and wrong for all mankind, but you don't know it naturally, that's, you don't know it until God says it, that's positive moral, with a hyphen. Now, that exact terminology, as far as my research, what my research produced, that exact terminology was not available and in common use at the beginning of the 1600s. But by later in the 1600s, that language was in common use. Except if I recall correctly, the words were backward of that in other uses. I think it was moral positive, moral natural, and moral positive. But the Westminster Confession upon which this is based said positive, moral, but not as one term. And our term, positive moral, with a hyphen, is a later development. And it's a better way to put it, because it's not the best way to think of it, to referring to what we just read here, to think of it as positive, comma, moral. Really, the two concepts of positive and moral belong to one concept. They should be one term, positive moral or moral positive. But if I understand correctly what they did, the Baptists, in updating the language in 1677, they did not reverse the order of the two words because they wanted to keep the order that was already in the Westminster Confession and Savoy Declaration. But they did want to use the new development of being able to say moral natural and moral positive, which were hyphenated. So they hyphenated but kept the word order, positive moral. Now, I had a wonderful moment studying this several years ago when, in reading other things, I had come to the conclusion that this had to be hyphenated. Positive moral, because I had seen moral positive hyphenated in several other things. And so I emailed Dr. James Renahan and asked him, I said, in the original printings, as far as you know, was it hyphenated? He sent back, yes, it was hyphenated. Now, he may have come around by now because this was 10 years ago, but at the time, he did not agree with me on the importance of it. I told him, but he didn't grasp the significance of what I was getting at. And so anyway, he's the expert on this whole confession and understands it inside and out. I am only something of an expert on this one hyphen. So there is a hyphen there, and he said so. It's in the original edition, and I understand the importance of it. It's to make one term out of this. You can tell by the way that it is being instituted at creation. God says it to Adam. It's moral. It's right and wrong for our whole race. But you can also tell by the way it has to be said to be law that it's positive. So what is it? Positive moral or moral positive. I'd like to ask a question if you were able to follow that or add something to that. So what you're seeing here is that there is something that is natural law to this, that God must be worshipped. I mean, you can know that naturally. You know, people all over the world, they're worshipping something as God. That God must be worshipped is known naturally. And that some time has to be used, obviously, where you're worshiping instead of working. And so then there has to be some ratio or proportion of what time is being used for worship and what time is being used for work and recreation. And that's all of that is can be known naturally. But only by His Word, in a positive moral commandment, do you know what exactly those things are. You know that it's one day and seven, and the day at creation appointed was the seventh of 7 days. Okay, so here we have the Sabbath day, or seventh day, the day God rested from all His creation and appointed that we rest, made it holy, sanctified it, hallowed it to Himself. Okay, fast forward to Exodus 20, if you please. We are skipping some really interesting stuff in between there. Hopefully, we get to review that in the future. Exodus 20. which of course is the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, starting in verse 8, the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. A reference to what we just read in Genesis chapter 2. Here we have the Sabbath day still as the seventh day of the 7 day week, and now we find it in the Ten Commandments, which God spoke with his own voice to Israel, carved into stone with his own finger, placed right in between "Shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain" and "honor thy father and thy mother," put down in a table of laws that we know are moral and perpetual, helping us to be sure of our interpretation of what we read in Genesis chapter 2. This is not something temporary. It's not just for Israel. This is not set down among all the many laws of all the feast days and ceremonies, etc. This is set down in the matters of right and wrong for all mankind. So we've had the Sabbath at creation. Now we have the Sabbath in the Ten Commandments. And I would say in the Ten Commandments, we get a clearer understanding that on the Sabbath day, you're not to do your regular work. Now, it was already sanctified at creation. It would already be known that you're not to just continue with your regular work, do your regular things on that day, because it's sanctified, hallowed, set apart to the Lord. But now it's specified very clearly. You and everybody else in your household is not to do your regular work on this day. It's part of what it is for it to be hallowed. At this point, would any of you brothers like to add something or ask something along these lines? Go ahead.
This is really, but you know how German language, they just create words by putting words together?
You end up with those super long compound words?
So I was just, here's my train of thought.
What?
I'm just thinking, I bet they've got a great word for moral positive.
In German, maybe they do.
They don't.
Oh, they don't?
Or at least I found a German translation of the 1689 Confession. And of course, then I had to run it through translator. So what it basically says is a clear, moral, and always valid command.
Well, yeah. All right.
It's from English to German to English.
Would you all turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5 for a minute? Deuteronomy chapter 5. And we want to, we can get some additional understanding of the blessing that this day is to us by reading at Deuteronomy 5. And near the end of verse 14, when it's talking about all the people and animals who aren't supposed to work, and it says that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. I find that extra explanation very helpful, because remember whom Moses is addressing. Those who either were young when the Exodus took place, or who weren't even born then. Those who either have no memory at all of being under forced labor, or their memories of it are from when they were kids 40 years ago. And so it's, remember, you were slaves or servants. You were forced laborers and presumably did not have one day off in seven, although the Bible doesn't say that. That's in the movie with Charlton Heston and everything, but that's all just imagined. That's, you know, presumably did not have the slave masters observing the Sabbath day, but whether they did or not, remember, because you will have forgotten. If you were born in the last 40 years out in the desert, you'll have to remember in the sense that you have no personal knowledge of it. Remember the stories. Or even if you were a slave in Egypt, it was 40 years ago, so remember, you've forgotten over the last 40 years. Remember what it was like to have to work hard all the time. And then when you rest on the Sabbath day, make sure that all the laborers who work for you rest also. It does not do for you to rest by means of having them keep on working. No, you need to remember that. Andrew, what?
It isn't the best thing to get promoted so you don't have to work on Sunday.
Right. Make manager so that you can just make other people work on the Lord's Day and you don't have to.
That's
right. Okay, so we're taking four looks, four glimpses into the blessing that God pours out on us by means of this special day, the Lord's Day. And we've taken two so far. We looked in at the very institution of it, Genesis chapter 2. We've looked in now at the giving of the Ten Commandments, including the extra explanation for those who needed it at the reminding Israel of the Ten Commandments. And now we're going to head for Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. Now we're skipping a lot, you know. We're getting the quickie version here. We're getting the abridged, the executive summary. Acts chapter 20 is Paul with companions traveling up to Jerusalem to try to be at Jerusalem in time for Feast of Pentecost, if I recall correctly. Trying to be at Jerusalem in time for the feast. And Acts chapter 20, we're going to, Acts chapter 20 verse 5, we're going to see what happens when he comes to the city of Troas. Acts 20 verse 5, these going before tarried for us at Troas, and we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. And there were many lights in the upper chamber where they were gathered together. And there sat in a window a certain young man named Eutychus, being fallen into a deep sleep. And as Paul was long preaching, he sunk down with sleep and fell down from the third loft and was taken up dead. And Paul went down and fell on him and, embracing him, said, "Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him." When he therefore was come up again and had broken bread and eaten and talked a long while, even till break of day, so he departed. And they brought the young man alive and were not a little comforted. You see there, we're getting another glimpse into the observance of one special day in seven. We have had a great change in things by now. Our confession says, "A Sabbath to be kept holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week, and from the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week. So, after Jesus Christ has risen from the dead, now forgiveness of sins in His name has been preached all over the place. Troas is relatively close to Jerusalem compared with places like Philippi and Corinth, and Rome would have been one of the earlier places to receive preaching of the gospel. And so people apparently have believed in Jesus and have been formed into a congregation, a church, an assembly. And notice that they come together not on the seventh day of the week. They come together on the first day of the week, verse 7. And notice that they did not come together because Paul was there. See verse 7, upon the first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread. It's not that they came together because the apostle was there. They came together to break bread. And notice what had happened just before that, at the end of verse 6, where we abode 7 days. Apparently, Paul arrived having just missed the assembly on the first day of the week. So now he is hurrying to get up to Jerusalem. But in order to meet with this church, he stays there 7 days, so that on the first day of the week, when the church comes together to break bread, Paul can be there with them and break bread with them and speak to them all night. So the special day, 1 in 7, is not now being observed by the church on the seventh day of the week. The seventh day of the week passes without special mention. The first day of the week is the day that gets the special mention, as the day when the disciples came together to break bread. Would any of you brothers like to ask a question at that point, or add something that might be helpful?
I always think, going back to the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. and Deuteronomy, with the explanation of how it's kind of like a sin in particular. Yes, Paul says it somewhere, probably Romans. Like if you're in bondage to sin, you're free now. Mm-hmm. You don't have to listen to that old master anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and it's sort of the exact same point that Moses is making there with the Sabbath day. Mm-hmm. Look, you have to work all the time. It brings to my mind the words of Jesus, the Sabbath is made for man. This is for your relaxation, among other things. Mm-hmm. So why in the world would you want to be like a slave to that?
Right.
A slave to a job, 7 days a week.
That's right. And if you get that idea that this is a blessing from God for me, then make sure that you love your neighbor as yourself. Make sure that you're thinking not only of yourself, but also of anybody who works for you. And interestingly, even your animals, which in the New Testament we're told, do not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain, is a commandment in which God is not primarily expressing concern for oxen, but for laboring people. Let it be that people who are laboring, that you don't withhold from them the pay that's due to them for what they're producing. And so, you know that as far as the Sabbath day, God does mention animals. He is concerned for animals, but his concern primarily is for people. It's a blessing, and so make sure you understand the blessing for yourself, but then make sure you also understand that other people need the blessing also. So speaking of blessing, here the church comes together. They come together on the first day of the week to break bread. They're going to eat together, and along with that, they're going to take the Lord's Supper, observe the Lord's Supper. And then the Lord blesses them in these interesting ways. They get to hear the apostle speaking to them long. He speaks all evening till about midnight, and then is interrupted, and then goes back to speaking and speaks until daylight. Now, they're not going to get to hear the Apostle Paul speaking anymore after this. He's making the most of it, and so are they. But they get blessed by the Lord in that. And then also, there's this wonderful, this amazing miracle. Here is this young man who can't or doesn't keep himself awake, falls to his death at church, which we typically have a little safer seating arrangement now. Although I think probably a lot of places in the world, maybe they don't have just a, you know, nice room made for the purpose and chairs to sit in. There might be precarious seating arrangements at some other places. But then, by the grace of God, the apostle is able to go and miraculously revive the young man who fell to his death. The Lord is blessing the church there in that first day of the week gathering. Now, let's turn next to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. There is a dearth or famine in Judea. The poor saints in Jerusalem are very impoverished. Over in Greece, over in Achaia and Macedonia, the people are not experiencing that. And so the apostle is taking up a collection from the churches in Asia and in Greece, and he's going to take it to the poor saints in Jerusalem. And here's the instructions for how to do this. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. And when I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. And if it be meet that I go also, they shall go with me. Okay, so there's a collection for the poor saints to be taken up. And the instruction is that it be done on the first day of the week. So there is a special day. There's some day that is the day of, that it is appropriate to do this, and that day is the first day of the week. If you're reading through the Bible, by the time you get to this, you're not surprised at this. You've read that Jesus has risen on the first day of the week. You've read that the church at Troas meets on the first day of the week to break bread, and now you're reading from the apostle that the setting by part of what you have profited is to be done on the first day of the week. And then he says, so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Now that helps you understand what he means by setting something by in store. Because if it just means every person at home takes some of his profit from that week and sets it by in his drawer, then if that were what he meant, then when the apostle came, collections would still need to be made. So when he says that every person set by in store as God has prospered him, so that when I come, no collections will have to be made, That means that the setting by in store needs to be done on the individual basis. Here's my money, and here's how God has prospered me this week, so I'm going to set some by. But then it's going to have to be collected on the first day of the week when the church comes together in order for it to be that no collection has to be made when Paul gets there. I don't know exactly why Paul is working it exactly this way, but he doesn't want it to be that Paul comes to town, and when Paul comes to town, then there's got to be money collections. You can put that together with what he says some other places. You know, he would travel, and he would get to some place, and money that had been given to him before, where he was before, or money that he earned working as a tent maker, that would be what paid his expenses, and he wouldn't accept any money from the people in the place where he was. Apparently, to make it abundant, to be able to prove to everyone, he has not come here to try to give speeches and collect money like a professional orator. So it has something to do with that practice. He doesn't want to be open. He understands the importance of his preaching ministry. He knows that he is the apostle to the Gentiles. And he understands that what he might be accused of, well, that might be anything. But what could actually be, what he could credibly be accused of, he wants to be very careful of. So if he goes someplace and as soon as he arrives, then everybody takes up a bunch of money and gives it to him, then there could be accusations that he's just trying to get people's money, and there would seem to be evidence for that. Look, when he comes, there's a big collection taken. So I think it was something about that, although I'm not certain. But he wants to be very careful about the handling of other people's money. He's not trying to get their money for himself, for sure. He's just wanting to collect it and transport it to the saints who are in very bad shape in Jerusalem. So this is to be done on the first day of the week. You have in Acts the evidence that the apostle and one of the early churches are meeting to break bread on the first day of the week. Okay? Now you have this, that one of the apostles is writing to take up your collections for the poor saints on the first day of the week. Okay? Would any of you brothers like to help by adding something or asking something along those lines? Well, I would like to say something more while we're at that point. What we have done now over the centuries is take that apostolic instruction about the collection. It was a certain collection at that time. You know, it was a collection to be taken up from all the churches and sent to Jerusalem. It was a certain collection. But now we have taken that apostolic instruction and considered it instruction to all the churches regarding our collections in general. You know, we need to collect money to pay the utility bills. We need to collect money to pay the pastor's salary and whatever other expenses there are. And following the apostle's instruction for that particular offering, what we do is we take an offering on the first day every week. Every person is expected according to how God has prospered him, expected to set aside a portion and put it in the offering. And on a practical basis then, that makes it to where the pastor, when he needs to be paid, doesn't have to be trying to take up a collection. Okay, everybody, my family's out of money, you know, let's take up a collection now. Which presumably would put the pastor in the same kind of situation that Paul was trying to avoid for himself. And, you know, then the money is already collected so that when there's the need for it, it's already collected. It doesn't have to be collected when the need comes up, unless it's some highly unusual need for which the regular collection hasn't been sufficient. Okay? and then Revelation 1:10. Revelation 1:10, which we read earlier. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. So after all that has come before, the original creation ordinance, one day and seven, that the seventh day is it, the inclusion of this in the Ten Commandments, especially leaning on don't work on this day, neither you nor your servants, and then the change of observance to the first day of the week, to where the apostle and the church are observed, ignoring the seventh day and having the first day be their special day. We now arrive at the end of the Bible, and we have the apostle John, which if the dating, you know, theory of this being in the mid 90s is true, he is very likely the last apostle and very old, and he's the one that all the churches in Asia look to, and he is referring to this as the Lord's day. Now, in our confession of faith, this calling it the Lord's day is to be understood that it is the one day in seven from creation that is being referred to as the Lord's day. Now, that is very standard Puritan stuff. The high water mark in understanding the doctrine of the Sabbath and the Lord's Day came in the mid to late 1600s in the Puritan context. And, of course, you know I would say this, but I say it because it's true. The expression of the Sabbath doctrine in the Second London 1677-1689 version of the Puritan Confession, you know, Irish Articles, early 1600s, Archbishop James Usher, Church of Ireland, Westminster Confession, 1640s, Presbyterian, Savoy Declaration, 1650s, Independent Congregationalist, Second London Confession of Baptist Faith, 1677, Baptist. That, you know, that whole series of confessions, you know, I consider basically the Puritan Confession of Faith. This is what the Puritans and the Puritan movement and the Puritan churches, this is what they believed the Bible to mean by what it says. And in that century, in that tradition, those people writing their articles, reading each other's articles, writing their books on the Ten Commandments, preaching their sermons on the commandments and the Lord's Day and etc. What they came up with, nobody has ever understood or expressed it better. By the time you read what we're reading here in our confession, it's not like, okay, but then in the 1800s, then people figured out the Sabbath better. No, I think they got it, and nothing better has been come up with since then. That, so this calling, understanding that when John says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, that the Lord's day, by that they mean the one day out of seven in its new designation on the first day of the week instead of the original seventh day of the week. That is very standard Puritan stuff. We're not reading something that's distinctive to the Baptist men, but this was essentially the Puritan findings and consensus from that whole century. Apparently, those who know the Greek literature of the time, and for the next 100 years after that, there are many references in the early Christian documents to the Lord's Day and by it, meaning the first day of the week. So it's really not a question for those who have studied into it what John was referring to. He was referring to the first day of the week when the churches assemble. So what we're, and so then here's John, and he's of course on the island of Patmos in exile. But what happens to him on the Lord's Day? You know, we were talking about this last week. He was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Apparently meaning like Paul and Peter before him, he went into a trance. The Holy Spirit gave him these amazing visions on the Lord's Day. And then these letters for the churches. The letters are to be sent to the churches. All these visions are to be written down and sent out to the churches. And what's going to happen then in the churches? They're going to come together on the first day of the week to break bread. They're going to find that somebody has a letter from John. And they're going to read it to the churches on the first day of the week, on the Lord's Day. So the Lord's Day then is the blessing that it was from creation. It's the blessing that it was in the time of the Ten Commandments. It's the blessing that it was in Troas when the Apostle Paul was there. But it's then the culmination of all of that, so that when we are able to come together, we come together on one day of the week, setting aside our normal work and entertainments. And then we expect, well, what kind of blessings are there going to be for us? There's going to be the physical rest from our labor. There's going to be the celebration or the recognition, remembrance, the worship of Jesus Christ according to his resurrection. There's going to be the preaching and teaching, which won't normally go on all night long, although every once in a while I suppose it might be the long preaching. There will be the opportunity to give offerings and collect them and maybe distribute them as they're needed. There'll be the reading in every church of what the Lord has provided for every church. It was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Would any of you brothers like to add to that or ask something along those lines?
I can play devil's advocate with myself on behalf of like a Seventh-day Sabbatarian.
Uh-huh, right.
And I would say maybe as this devilish Seventh-day person, I might use the same arguments against me that I would use against a pedo-Baptist, saying, well, you know, you're kind of just going on a lot of inferences, you know. I mean, let's grant that the Lord's Day means the first day. That doesn't necessarily mean that we abandon Saturday and worship only on Sunday. And, you know, yeah, okay, we have examples of people meeting together to break bread, but it doesn't mean they're partaking of the Lord's Supper. I mean, it could be our Wednesday gathering, for example. You know, they just use those sort of arguments against me. And,
Yes, I think that particular thing, it's good to think it through, but, you know, it won't stand the question, you know, does it make sense? Is it sensible that there will now be two Sabbath days a week? You know, it won't be that the seventh day Sabbath is still to be observed and the first day of the week is also to be observed. You know, that won't hold water.
I imagine he had some reason for saying this, but Robert Godfrey of his history church said that it doesn't care that for some people, at least, the Jewish Christians for a while, did do both. They went to synagogue on Saturday and church on Sunday until tensions got too high. The synagogue leaders said stop it. The church, the Christian leaders also were like, yeah, it should be good.
Yeah, maybe they did.
But yeah, but they get back to, and I guess one of my rebuttals to myself, you know, it's sort of a pedo-Baptist argument, really, but kind of appealing to longevity. Because, you know, you're talking about, you know, the Puritans being the big packs of God. But, I mean, maybe as far as a really articulate reasoning, but yes, since at least the time of John, if not the time of Acts, it's been mislaid.
Right.
So, but for me, my other, and again, I know this isn't like perfect logic, but one reason I say a Sunday Sabbatarian is because if the Seventh-day Sabbatarians could keep their arguments at that, it would be convincing, but they also have to throw in a bunch of heretical ideas like soul sleep and annihilationism and very legalistic retaining of the Old Covenant in its entirety. And so I think,
so there have been in the past Seventh-day Baptists whose ideas did not include those. But you're definitely right in pointing out that at present, the main Seventh-day Sabbath advocates, the Seventh-day Adventists, and the Hebrew Roots movement, they include a number of doctrines along with that practice, which are very clearly, as you said, heretical, false, and it kind of discredits them generally, making me not that interested in their doctrines of the Seventh-day Sabbath.
Kind of along the same lines, you know, again, probably committing a fallacy here, but so many cults have arisen, you know, and Jehovah's Witnesses kind of sprang from it, branch dominions. I watch these videos on YouTube, they're top tens, just list of stuff that's, you know, non-Christian prior. But they had top 10 doomsday cults. You know, people like the Branch Davidians and stuff. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them started from Seventh-day Adventist backgrounds. So, I don't know. Yeah, I'm like you. That makes me leery.
Right.
What is it about you that
doesn't
see better?
Doesn't prove anything about so-and-so or so-and-so, but it does make you maybe have take extra caution. So I, obviously, I put to you the kindness of God our Creator in granting us the Sabbath day. I put to you the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I urge on you extra meditation on that and worship according to that, not once a year, not one day a year, but one day in seven. I urge on you an expectant mind regarding the Lord's Day. Expect that the Lord will help you with your work 6 days a week, and expect that He will bless you spiritually when you approach Him in faith, sanctifying one day a week. All right, let us pray over this and be done for now.